Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, WFHB's Backyard Conversation on Race and Privilege. On Thursday, October 27th, WFHB's Interchange hosted a panel discussion in the Monroe County Public Library Auditorium. The panel was about race and privilege and was coined a backyard conversation in hopes to talk about issues surrounding race, racism, privilege, and policing, with an emphasis on the local. The panel was hosted by Interchange's host, Doug Storm. The panelists included Bernice Sanchez, who is a current doctoral student at IU School of Education and past assistant director of La Casa Cultura Latina at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Russell Moa, Associate Professor of American Studies and Associate Professor in Recreation, Park, and Tourism Studies at the School of Public Health, Jennifer Brooks, a co-chair of Showing Up for Racial Justice in Bloomington and a WFHB volunteer, and William Morris, Civil Rights Attorney and member of the Bloomington Civil Rights Commission, and Rita Myers, Associate Professor in the Department of History and Gender Studies, moderated the panel. We begin with WFHB's Doug Storm introducing the panel.
This is our first WFHB Community Conversation. I'm Doug Storm, host and producer of Interchange. Tonight's program on race and privilege is called a backyard conversation, obviously because we're trying to talk about the local here. I'll give you a brief outline of how this event came to be and in the process hopefully show you by broad strokes what we're going to get into in detail tonight. If you saw our news release or heard our promos about the event, you know that topics to be discussed tonight include race, racism, privilege, policing, and with a special emphasis on the local. About 6 months ago, Jennifer Brooks, one of tonight's panelists, asked me if she could develop an Interchange episode on white privilege. Since neither of us exactly knew what that should look like, we set about doing what we always do on Interchange, looking for a national author to interview and maybe a local academic as well. But each of us kept finding articles and research essays about the subject that deepened our understanding, but also confounded what we thought white privilege meant and how we should approach it, especially as two privileged white adults. So this was the solution. We asked outspoken and thoughtful people to speak about these tensions. It's one of the problems that we seek to confront, that a white perspective is considered normative in the United States, and thus by definition excludes perspectives from people of color. The narrative of protest has also been offered through this same lens. Media outlets generally report on disruption and inconvenience, and the clash of protesters with police or those who feel unduly affected by protests. What does our media obfuscate in our understanding of racism in our communities? Finally, there's a kind of response that we seek to address. Why are aggrieved protesters expected to be civil? We confront the legacy of slavery while being assured that slavery is in the past. Of course, when students at our North High School decide to come to school wearing the Confederate flag as capes, it should be clear to all we are not living in a post-racial nation. And the amped-up rhetoric of constructing a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico ought to make it plain that the political use of fear and hate will continue to create obstacles to our understanding. These are some of the questions and quandaries that led to the creation of tonight's event. Our moderator, Amrita Chakrabarty Myers, specializing in African American history and women's history, is a historian of the black female experience, interested in race, gender, sexuality, power, and freedom, and the ways in which these constructs intersect with one another in the lives of black women in the Old South. She's now at work on her second book, Remembering Julia, an antebellum tale of sex, race, power, and place, and is the Ruth Ann Halls Associate Professor of History and Gender Studies at Indiana University. I'll introduce the panelists now. Jennifer Brooks grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. In January of this year, she became producer of Activate, a weekly feature of the Daily Local News that features interviews with local volunteers and activists. In the fall of 2015, she co-founded the local chapter of Showing Up for Racial Justice, a national network that mobilizes white people to work for racial justice. Jennifer holds a bachelor's degree in history from California State University at Chico and a master's degree in world history from San Francisco State University. William Morris is an attorney with Indiana Legal Services, where he works extensively in homelessness prevention and other areas assisting people struggling with poverty. William has worked in housing law and other areas of poverty prevention for over 20 years. He's served on both the Bloomington and Monroe County Human Rights Commissions, and he's one of the founders of the Indiana Moral Mondays movement. Russell Mowat is an associate professor in the Department of American Studies within the School of Public Health in Bloomington. His primary areas of research and teaching are associated with social justice, leisure studies, cultural studies, and critical pedagogy. His published work has covered analyzing lynchings as violent forms of leisure, a critique of whiteness that dominates discourse in academic and professional fields. His interests and concerns are strongly centered on critiquing society for issues that are most prevalent in impacting quality of life. And finally, Bernice Sanchez, a second-year doctoral student at Indiana University, pursuing a PhD in higher education and student affairs. She served as the assistant director of La Casa Cultura Latina at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign before beginning her studies. She currently serves as the assessment coordinator at the Office of Student Life and Learning at Indiana University. Her research focuses broadly on the experiences of minoritized populations within higher education, specifically looking at Latina graduate students and faculty.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Since we're focusing on the local here tonight, you know, most of the activism work that I do is a blend of the two, but certainly focuses a lot on the national scene and how that relates to what's happening here in Bloomington. One of the things that kept coming up over and over again is that, oh no, this is not a racist place, but there's that racist town, you know, Martinsville. And that had a familiar ring to my ear because everywhere I've lived or traveled or been in my life, people always say, oh no, we are the exception to the rule. There's that place over there, that town, that state. I grew up in Canada, the Canadians saying, oh, racism, that's that U.S. thing down there. The Northerners saying, oh, that's that thing down in the South, Alabama, Mississippi, you know, not here in New Jersey or New York. There's always this deflection, this uncomfortable realization that there's a lot going on here, but we don't want to talk about it. It's uncomfortable, and therefore it's easier to deflect it and place it on some other person or place. When I moved here and I started to see on a daily basis the kinds of racialized incidences that happen here, and of course realizing very quickly that, you know, there is racism here. It just maybe looks a little bit different than it does in other places. And sometimes it doesn't look very different at all. It's my graduate student who is walking down Kirkwood Avenue, and she's African-American, with her white husband, and a pickup truck rolls by with a group of young white men inside who holler the N-word with the word lover attached to it at the end of it, being directed at her white husband who's walking down the street holding her hand. It's one of my undergraduate students who's a white woman going to Walmart with her black boyfriend and being glared at and people muttering things under their breath or even directly to them when they're in the store, and her getting heated and wanting to respond and her black boyfriend saying, you got to keep it under control. I've been dealing with this my whole life. We just laugh it off, leave, just kind of trying to keep the peace. And then when I relay those kinds of stories to people, the response often being, oh, well, maybe those things happen, but it's a towny thing. That academic university community trying to say that this is something that happens with these local folks. There's that town gown divide rearing its ugly head in some really strange ways because, boy, oh boy, we want to talk about racism on the university campus. We can do that. What about the traditionalist youth network established on our campus a couple of years ago, which resulted in not just name calling, but fights and physicality and arrests? What about the Joseph Smedley case? One of our very few black IU freshmen died last year, and his fraternity brothers didn't bother to report him missing. Nobody really seemed to think that there was anything to be worried about. It was only because his sister pressured administrative officials on campus and continues to pressure them and the local police today that they can't just close it and walk away. Either make black people hyper-visible as thugs and deviants or invisible when they are being killed or when they are suffering or experiencing pain. What about when students exercise their First Amendment rights to protest, peacefully protest, on Columbus Day? And no one talks about the reason that they're out protesting, but it's really discomforting to people that they're being asked to redirect themselves in terms of traffic. And one gentleman decided that even though the protesters were peaceful, saying please and thank you, and we can even redirect you, you know, he decided that it would be okay to put his foot on the gas and try to drive through a group of peaceful protesters. And the comments that followed the news articles, in my opinion, was shameful. in terms of the protesters being described as rioters and looters and aggressive and angry and dangerous, about peaceful protesters, people exercising their First Amendment rights. We need to confront and converse about the fact that it is here. It is here because we live in America. It is here because America has institutionalized structural racism. This is not a gown issue. This is not a town issue. This is a human issue, and every single person who lives in this country is responsible for talking about it, because if you're not talking about it and actively working to dismantle it, your silence is complicity, and it's part of the problem. It's part of the problem. It is our issue. We all live here. This is our home. This is our community. Many of us are parents, and we have children who go to school here. We are neighbors. We are colleagues. We are friends. We need to have a conversation.
I've been interested in issues of racism for a long time. A turning point for me was a book, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. I was one of those people who thought, wow, I'm glad we're past that. And this book in particular, it shocked me. And I was resistant to the hypothesis of this book, that there had been, through mass incarceration, a continuation of Jim Crow and really of disenfranchisement based on racial lines. That book really got me thinking in a new way. White people, we need to get involved in a different way. We need to relearn history. We need to unlearn the history that's been taught to us that has served this narrative that criminalizes people of color, that so often depicts people of color as thugs, as criminals, as happy to be in a subservient place, and that so often situates white people in positions of authority and sort of as the normative centerpiece, the cornerstone.
One thing is that, you know, this particular current environment that we're in is very hard for us to think. More so the sense that information is so readily accessible. We're passing so much information on and we're not being able to digest it. And what does that mean? Issues that are impacting lives are never a part of the actual discussions of things. So when we're seeking sort of a sense of what should happen, what could happen, we're not getting that particular answer. And we're diverted to some other sort of conversation, and we're satisfied with that other conversation. And that current environment concerns me because it doesn't allow us to really see or to think. But lastly, I think a lot of our conversations as it relates to race or racism, that we always ground them in present day sort of examples and discussions. Newer texts, newer examples of situations that may occur when we have plenty of examples of these conversations that have taken place all the way to the 1880s. There's something that maybe in the history that can sort of give us a better insight because the time that it took for people to process and build the arguments that they presented then. And so, at least for me, you know, when we think about Bloomington is deemed progressive, but is it really just simply a more nuanced version of the status quo? So one thing that I'll probably try to react to, and you'll hear in my responses to any of your questions or points, is a move away from talking about privilege and more so talking about power. Power is the ability to determine one's reality. Who has that? Power to me is making one's thought reality. To conceive of anything and make it happen, that's incredible.
I've been having these conversations with some of my close friends since moving to Bloomington about feeling this sense of invisibility. As a Latina, both on campus and within the community, and just having reflection time about the black-white binary is real and alive and kicking here. And so trying to figure out how do I fit into that narrative as a community member in Bloomington and as a student in the classroom. And so I think that I finally got to the point where I'm like, okay, if I'm saying that I'm feeling invisible and I'm having this opportunity, then I really need to take advantage and take it. The use of language to me is really big. And so like Russell was saying, he doesn't use privilege, he uses power. I don't use privilege, I use white supremacy. I think that we need to go to the initial root of the issue. And so in all of these conversations, we need to talk about race and racism, but we also need to talk about white supremacy, and we need to talk about the patriarchy, and we need to talk about imperialism and capitalism and how they all really interplay to cause the injustices and the oppression of people and communities. Lastly, I think that it's great that people are willing to have these conversations, and I encourage people to have these conversations. In having these conversations too, we need to be very mindful of not rushing into finding solutions. Sometimes people just need to sit with the uncomfortableness of the conversation. We do just need to sit with those feelings of being uncomfortable, of being challenged, of being sad and frustrated, and just sit in our emotions before jumping into the solutions too quickly without fully understanding what's going on and the history behind it and all of the intricacies and all of the connections of the histories of people that are being impacted. It's going to end up just being a band-aid and not make any systemic change and structural change, which is really what is needed.
I am a child of Southern Indiana. So I was born in Southern Indiana of a white mother and a black father. So my perspective is very different. And I have people on both sides of these discussions. And I understand how much relationship building is really a big part of this. You know, I work with these poor white people. I go into their trailer homes. I see them with their Confederate flags up. I have to work with them, and I sort of get a sense of the poverty that we deal with when we talk about going to Martinsville, when we go to Spencer, when we go to Bedford. And we may criticize Bloomington, but this conversation is not taking place in any of these towns, in Nashville, nowhere else. It's taking place right here in Bloomington. So we got something special here. We may criticize what we have, and that's our right, and that's the beauty of being here. We have the opportunity to be on Interchange and to try to make this better, and we have this opportunity. So I'm very happy to be here, too. So many times in the United States history when the United States said black lives did not matter. You know, Dred Scott said black lives did not matter. Signing the Constitution with three-fifths of a man for a black person says black lives did not matter. Jim Crow said black lives did not matter. Then we turn that around. Martin Luther King says black lives do matter. Malcolm X says black lives do matter. Bobby Seale says black lives do matter. But it can get forgotten unless people stand up and say black lives matter. I have this white stepson, but you know, he is really sort of captivated by Colin Kaepernick. You know, and this whole thing that Colin Kaepernick was started out. Now, if people on Facebook, when Colin Kaepernick started doing his thing, you know, everybody was jumping on him and all, but that has sustained. And, you know, and not only that, but it has expanded to high schools and the white lady, the bi woman on the soccer team. I mean, there are many, many people starting to bow. They're trying to figure out in the NBA what you're going to do when they start bowing in the NBA, because it's coming too. So anyway, part of the solution, if there is a solution, is having dialogues like this. And I think we can be pleased that we can have this dialogue here.
You've been listening to WFHB's Backyard Conversation on Race and Privilege, on Standing Room Only, on WFHB. Been listening to a panel hosted by WFHB at the Monroe County Public Library on October 27th. The panel was hosted by Interchange's Doug Storm and was about race and privilege with an emphasis on the local. We now return to moderator Emerita Myers asking the panel her next question.
The people in this room are here because clearly we feel like there's a problem. Otherwise we wouldn't be here. That we want to do something. The same something that drove Jen to eventually help co-found the Bloomington Surge chapter. Well, that something is the fact that it is white supremacy. It is about power. Boy, let me tell you one thing that I hate more than the word white privilege: implicit bias. Is there really a lot of people in the U.S. today still who honestly can say that they are completely unconscious and unaware, and that it's implicit, and they're just not?
I think there's something
they don't understand.
Those things that's out there. There's anger. That's amongst all the races. All of them are angry. The Hispanics are angry. The blacks are angry. The whites are angry. Everybody's angry because they feel like we have a system that's broken and everybody's getting treated unfairly.
Well, so, I don't think it's broken at all. I think it's functioning exactly the way it was meant to.
Yes.
It was created to keep white people in power. It was it's a system of white supremacy, so I don't think it's broken. Not one little bit. I think the anger is being created from the fact that people are tired of that system being in place on the one side, and on the other side, we got a bunch of people who are trying frantically to keep that system in place. There's some common threads that we're seeing here, right? Power, supremacy, anger, right? Poverty, all of these things. But we're here because we want to do something. And the question is, what is that something? What are the things that you have been doing, and what are the things that you think perhaps might work best here in the local perspective? Because we are trying to make this about our community.
One of the things that I think has come up in here is that there's a lot of different sort of social constructs and social identities that are navigating these conversations. We've got white and black, academic, town, privileged, not poor. So there's a lot of ways that we embody the world. We all bring our own perspectives into this conversation. And, you know, for me in particular, thinking about what is my role in a conversation around racial justice as a white person? So in part, the reason I was attracted to this group showing up for racial justice is that it is specifically about mobilizing white people. And that's twofold. So it's one, to be in support of the work and effort that people of color are making in defense of their own dignity, in defense of their own livelihood. And to be able to show up in that space without being that sort of white savior. How do I have this conversation with other white people who are well-intentioned? And I was talking about this discussion, and she asked, I don't understand why people say Black Lives Matter. Doesn't that mean that other lives don't matter? I think it was somebody on the radio who said, was talking about this very topic, and he said, you know, if my ankle is broken, my ankle bone matters to me most at that point. It doesn't mean the rest of the bones in my body don't matter, but right now my focus is on the ankle because it's broken.
Dealing with the injustice first is so important, is that helps you to sort of focus the work that you're going to do. Then what are some issues as it relates to race here in Bloomington? And so one of the things in our sort of chiding of Bloomington is that sort of sense of lack of presence. Where was this community? Where was a sort of concentrated Black community? Not necessarily to say whether or not I was going to live there or not, but the interaction, the sense of contact, the sense of, at least for me, normalcy that you see in every city. That sort of gives me the sense of the issue of race, is that sense of representation. It does mean something, especially for a place that claims itself to be progressive, because then if we look at the campus, when we see three times, four times the number of building service workers of color or Black than actual faculty, then you begin to see that issue of that representation that first started with the sort of lack of presence of the neighborhood. Because as we know with the history, that Black neighborhood is the reason why so many Black students were able to survive here, you know, because they couldn't stay on campus and they had to find a place to stay. The lack of not having one now, what does that do to the current students? And so then how does that transfer to then other populations of color? You know, as we talked, you know, in terms of brown, like, where do you go, you know, just for resource? You know, where do you go just for normalcy? You know, where do you go for just socializing? Even if you're not going to take advantage of those opportunities, the feeling that that's there gives you a sense of security. Because in that space, you can exert or create some sense of power.
Being on the education side and coming from student affairs, if we were to have a good first step would be, I mean, it's such an individual thing. And I think that self-reflection and education is such a big thing. And I think that a lot of times when having these conversations across racial groups, there's this sense of leaning on the communities of color to educate everybody else without then stepping back and realizing that even though many times we do it because we want people to know really what's going on, it also can be a burden to some of those people. And it's also even more oppression placed on them, right? Of having this obligation to have to teach other people. And I've sat in classes when we were having these conversations and a white classmate said, well, you know, if you all don't tell me your story, then how am I supposed to learn? And I just sort of looked to my peers and was like, I'm pretty sure there's all kinds of history books and blogs and like...
The internet is an amazing thing.
You know, I'm just saying, if people really wanted to learn, there's a lot of avenues for people to learn. And so I think that for me, I struggle when people come at me saying, you know, people are well-intentioned or people didn't mean it or people, like, I think people know very well what they're doing, the system in which they're functioning and what's going on. I think that I struggle with really accepting that some people really don't know what's going on and don't have the means to find out if that's the case. And so I think that a first good step for a lot of people is putting that accountability upon themselves to do that work. Because I, regardless of where I show up, I'm going to be a Latina, a woman, a daughter of immigrants, and that's never going to go away. And that's sort of what I carry with myself. And I need to work to be able to function in all of these different spaces that I'm in. For those people who do have the privilege to not have to think about maybe these other oppressed identities, I think that they also need to take on that responsibility and that accountability.
Or call Clarence at WFHB or call William with the NAACP. There are some local resources.
Of course.
Yeah, there's the Commission for the Status of Black Men, and we're always looking for brothers like Brother Russell to come on over there. And there are other organizations, I think, in Bloomington that offer that opportunity, that take you off campus and deal with folks that really live in Bloomington. And I think that's a real dynamic here. And if you want to see another part of Bloomington, go to Walmart on Friday night. They're probably not here tonight because we don't have a mechanism for communicating with them. They have to be able to come to a table somewhere where we can talk to them and figure out what the hell's going on in their minds. The parents of this kid walking around with this Confederate flag, what the hell are you thinking, man? What's going on? But if that person is not a part of the dialogue, then I don't know exactly. So I don't know how we build all these relationships. And it's complicated and it's challenging. And it really calls for reaching across the aisle and reaching across 37. You know, you have an opportunity then to bring in some magic of healing. It's possible, but you got to be able to talk to people. If you can't talk to them, then it's very hard for that to happen.
To that, you mentioned Clarence, the Bring It On team, which Amrita's of.
Which and this, I'm a part of.
That's right.
Yes.
So for those of you who don't know, this is a public affairs program about and for African Americans here in Indiana. It's, I think, the only one of its kind in the state.
6 p.m. every Monday evening on WFHB. We have intersectional lives and intersectional experiences, and even within the Black community, right, that there are divisions and tensions over sexuality, right, and how that's affecting Black churches, that there's gender tensions that are still very, very prevalent, even within our current, you know, Black Lives Matter and liberation movements, where the fact that Black Lives Matter was founded by three Black queer women often gets overlooked and ignored when people are sort of like constantly talking only about the Black men that have been violated, abused, and murdered by the police, and forget about the transgendered folks, the gay folks, and the sisters who are going down too, right? And it's not just Sandra Bland. And I think the media is a big part of that problem because they direct the conversation in certain ways and help us focus on certain people, and that gets picked up. And I think that those sorts of tensions need to be addressed. We need to think about sexuality. We need to think about gender. We need to think about the fact that the community is not one community. That doesn't mean that we can't come together on issues, but that we have to be sensitive to each other's contexts and differences too.
I felt compelled to stand up as soon as you started talking about the invisibility of Black women in this movement. Because that's something that I'm currently facing here in Bloomington. I agree with both sides, right? Bloomington is a blue dot in this red state, but that's a lot of smoke that they're blowing around, right? Like it's progressive. We're fairly liberal, but there is still a lot of stuff that we have to dig into and uncover that is not happening. One thing that I'm specifically concerned about is educating our kids. I have my child, my oldest child is two. Okay, so they're he's a baby, but the prison, the preschool to prison pipeline is very real. People identifying Black boys specifically as early as 2 years old is very real. I'm experiencing it. And while for a long time it was just a story of someone else, it's now up. It's in my life, right? It's in my life. And I'm now being faced with a challenge of trying to push these teachers, these educators, using a voice of someone who is the least protected, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I am feeling that burden of people not hearing me as a Black woman and still having something very valid, very critical to say. And while I appreciate movements like Surge, I've worked with other Surge chapters in the past in my work, I don't know if I want my white allies to have to back me up in that moment. I need to figure out where there's a space that people who can immediately identify with what I'm feeling can congregate in this community. Where is that? Like, how do we rally around identities, like specific targeted intentional identities to kind of like push this discussion and dialogue further amongst ourselves, but also with people who are handling our babies, you know, because it's the babies who are going to come up to be wearing Confederate flags on their back. And we had issues in 97 when I was there. So this is not new.
No.
But like, where are these groups that we can continue this discussion outside of these rooms, that we can lend protection to each other, that we can lend support? And if they're not there, how do we start them?
Darcy, I can certainly say right now, I know that there are, including one brother sitting right here, William, and I know there's another woman, Miss Carter, Stephanie Carter. Is that right? Stephanie Power Carter. They're trying to go ahead and put together some local folks that are people, you know, brothers and sisters who are going to start trying to create a committee that starts to dialogue about the inequalities in the MCCSC. And I know that that's an attempt. And we really need a voice like yours. We need a voice of somebody whose child is coming up and who is feeling the invisibility. And I think this is part of that communication. And so I would, just as a quick connection, I would ask you to talk to William. And I know maybe to the relief of some folks, I don't know, I want to say we got some new leadership coming up in our local NAACP, and many of us are very excited about the possibility of freeing up a bottleneck and let's get on back to work. So I know the Education Committee is going to be doing a lot of work, and it would be wonderful to have your voice on it.
You've been listening to WFHB's Backyard Conversation on Race and Privilege, on Standing Room Only on WFHB. Listening to a panel hosted by WFHB at the Monroe County Public Library on October 27th. The panel was hosted by Interchange's Doug Storm and was about race and privilege with an emphasis on the local. We now return to an audience member question.
Hello, my name is Stanley Jaguna. I'm a sophomore at Indiana University. I'm a leading member of a student group called Students for a Democratic Society, seeking to inspire civic engagement and mass mobilization of students for the political revolution. No.
Just Students for a Democratic Society.
Students.
Wait, what is that acronym?
Students for a Democratic Society is the title. Okay, I just gave you the tagline along with it. I probably made it.
Students,
you know,
for a Democratic Society, okay. SDS. Yes.
Right. We are the renewed version of IU's original.
2.0, you sold me this summer.
2.0,
right?
Yeah. SDS 2.0. So in a lot of my activist work and organizing work, I'm, you know, possessed with this question of what's going to make people, like, snap, like, commit. And when I say snap, I mean commit to doing what it takes to get out in the streets, to get into the policy discussions, to pressure public officials. And I see that pretty much the cultural impetus that keeps people complacent and willing to conform or assimilate is this notion that they have to maintain the idea of American exceptionalism, that no matter what sort of change that we're calling for, we must maintain the idea that America is great and awesome and we always do the right things, and that we did the systems of oppression were unintended or, you know, just externalities, right? And I feel like a lot that can, to provide an example, that can be the reason why, for example, progressives in Bloomington are sort of reluctant or, excuse my language, half-assed towards these sort of discussions on race, or why I see my friends who are politically engaged, but more on the side of the party, right, will sort of feel like they can proxy their advocacy through the party, right, and through that, like what we saw at the Democratic National Committee and how we were really stuffed with a ton of exceptionalism, right? And with that exceptionalism, there's also this interaction that occurs where the authenticity of the message and the rhetoric of these movements gets co-opted, diluted, and sort of just mixed into this bowl of topical identity politics, right? So how can we really start to uproot and dismantle or make people no longer reluctant to shedding this idea of American exceptionalism?
Well, it's hard to sort of answer the question about what will break it if that's your position, right? And I don't believe that's the issue, right? You know, so one, if people have needs that are being met by this society and you're trying to think of or conceive of another type of society and you're not providing anything in relation to those needs, why should they? Right? Why would they need to wake up? Right? Why? You know? And so that, I think that's always an important point. And when you said what the name of your organization is, and it's just, I have no idea what you all do, but I just want to make sure that, you know, whenever we appropriate historical names of organizations, that we also have to be respectful of that history. Mm-hmm. And maybe part of the issue internally that you were mentioning among your members is really not knowing the history of that organization. In the past, not to say that that's what you're trying to imitate, but I know that was the case a lot of times, especially in the 90s when there was a lot of on student campuses, Black Panther,
new
Black Panther Nation and stuff like that. And it's like
right.
If you're going to take on that name, then you need to know that history,
right,
and to respect the type of work that that name and that group has done before, or choose a new name. And so so I think a part of it is the type of work that they were doing, and that's why I'm speaking to that, because they did a lot more than just sort of challenge systems. They were actually beginning to provide resources and services.
Right.
You know, so when we see young Bernie Sanders, not old Bernie Sanders, when we see young Bernie Sanders, that's what he was doing. He was
in a dangerous situation.
Exactly. He was doing the reverse voter registration, going up to the north to assist people with voter education, running for office. That's what he was working on. And so all of a sudden, their needs were being met by something external to the society, which then made more people wish to be sort of awakened, right? Because it was like, oh, well, you know, this is important. But until we sort of meet the needs of where people are at, why should they ever choose to do something, different?
Well, that goes to that poverty question that I'm talking about. When you go into these areas where we work in southern Indiana, and you go into these areas where there's deep poverty and people can't pay the rent, they can't get medical, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Well, it's hard for them to see relational truths because their needs, if you look at some sort of, I'm not a real intellectual, but if you look at that hierarchy of needs, when your needs aren't getting met, it's easy for that other poison to get into your mind. And so that's why I really do think this whole thing, and that's what the SDS? Yes.
Students for Democracy.
So back then they would go off in the areas, they would cross 37. That was, they would go into dangerous places to get people to vote, to get people involved, even if they didn't know exactly where they stood. They thought they could get them signed up to vote and then educate them and get them straightened out. So there was a lot going on there that was very dynamic.
And one of the things that SDS was important, and I appreciate you giving that also history specifically to hear, is that they saw, whiteness, as a part of white supremacy, right? Again, that Berenice, brought up at the beginning, right? And that's important to sort of give a context to, because when we see white poverty, that's an example of failure to live up to your whiteness, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You know, so if you're white and poor, you did something wrong, right?
Like the word white trash, right?
Exactly. Right. So you need to be sort of hidden mm-hmm. and away from sight. You need to be, you know, because you don't have your sort of act together, right? Mm-hmm. Because you need to be affirmed, because in race, everybody is raced, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody. And mm-hmm. so part of the ascription of being white is to be dominant. And if you are incapable of being dominant, then you're a failure.
You know, sort of dawning realization that although Bloomington is like one of the wealthiest places in the state of Indiana, Monroe County has one of the highest poverty rates in the state of Indiana, right? And one of the largest homeless population rates. And I was frustrated enough that, you know, I kept thinking, well, you know, we need to do something about this. And I finally thought to myself, okay, Amrita, what are you going to do about this? Because sitting around, like, feeling crappy about the fact that this was happening wasn't really helping anybody. And so just for myself, I felt led to actually start volunteering, mm-hmm. right? And that was something that I chose to do because I felt like it was important. And what was interesting, I mean, I've been doing this now for 6 years. But one of the things that I found was really important is that so many of the men and women that I have met and continue to meet, many of whom have become people who know me by name and who I know, because the homeless population is like, they don't stop being homeless. It's like long-term homelessness that I'm talking about. Right. It was interesting. Like when I first started volunteering, they were like, oh yeah, she won't be here for long. She's one of those IU professors. Right. And after a while, it was like, oh, that's Amrita. She works at IU. And then it was, that's our professor. Because they began to actually get to know who I was, and they began to trust me because I began building relationships with them and talking with them and hanging out with them. As opposed to, like, in addition to checking them in and getting them settled, I would sit and I would talk with them and drink coffee with them and just get to know them and know their positionalities and what brought them to this space and why they were where they were. And I got to learn about the fact that even though some of them had jobs and money, they couldn't rent an apartment because they failed a security check because they had prison records, right? And the fact that so many of them were self-medicating with drugs and alcohol because they had mental illnesses, but they had no health insurance, or they were veterans with PTSD and couldn't get help. Those were things that I would never have known had I not bothered to actually get involved somewhere and start to actually meet people where they were.
Just within the past couple of weeks, maybe the past month, it was announced that in March, Bloomington is going to take in a decent number of refugees from Syria and then a couple of different countries in Africa. And I saw when the news first broke, a lot of people just kind of blindly celebrating this fact, and especially white liberals kind of blindly celebrating this fact. And while I think it's good that Bloomington is making an effort to help refugee populations, I was wondering if any of you had any anxieties around this topic, given the current racial climate here in Bloomington, in Monroe County as a whole.
I think it's going to work because I think that there are a sufficient number of people, good-hearted people, who want to try to do the right thing. And I think that they have the resources that as problems arise, they'll be able to meet them, whatever they may be. But I know that I know people who are actively going to be involved in this, perhaps even providing housing. And so I think that we're going to do an exemplary job in the state of Indiana.
But do you think it's going to cause tension when we already have homeless and impoverished people here who are going to say, oh, so there's resources for refugees coming from Syria, but not for those of us who are already here? I think that's actually, I'm pushing the conversation. I want you to think about that and talk to that.
Mm. I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question. I also am extensively involved. We're working in that community, and I don't know that the folks who will receive the services, I have not heard of any commentary from the folks that receive services that they're feeling a resentment toward more people coming in. I think the pools are so different that I'm not so sure they see them as taking from the same pool. So I don't know.
I think what they said sort of stands in terms of the infrastructure that's waiting for them to come. But I think in terms of hostility, I think we should be cautious into thinking that there's a new such type of hostility that's present, as if that hostility wasn't already here. Yeah. Climate is more preparing just in general, right? Because the hostilities are, you know, already exist, and the biggest thing is making sure the infrastructure is present. Because if there are no infrastructure, then of course they're not going to find housing. So next thing you know, they're going to be, you know, out in the street. And then if they're not out in the street, then they'll be easily vulnerable to, you know, whoever, you know. And then so infrastructure is needed. And so places like Bloomington does have that. But now the concern is if they go to certain counties and cities where there's not that type of infrastructure.
You've been listening to WFHB's Backyard Conversation on Race and Privilege on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to a panel hosted by WFHB at the Monroe County Public Library on October 27th. The panel was hosted by Interchange's Doug Storm and was about race and privilege with an emphasis on the local. We now return to Emerita Myers asking her next question.
Just last year, a local female business owner who is Muslim was attacked and beaten pretty viciously. So here in town. And so I guess what I'm thinking is, how are these already pre-existing tensions going to be exacerbated by a larger number? That's, please.
Yeah, there have been several meetings in terms of, like, Exodus refugees bringing in people, and there is a grassroots conservative organization who has been present at those meetings and has been, you know, like, vocally, you know, violent towards the presenters and has, you know, have followed people to their cars. And these are just, you know, like, the white folks in the community that are kind of organizing around this. So I'm wondering if you think that there's a potential for those kinds of groups to maybe lash out at these people once they're there.
And we have to look out for each other. I mean, I know that's not the solution, but, you know, one of the things that we have to do is speak up when it's when it doesn't feel comfortable, and maybe you feel like you're interjecting yourself in a space that you don't belong. I mean, PBS yesterday aired a program on a segment on NewsHour featuring a story of a group, the Traditionalist Worker Party.
Oh, I saw that.
And the leader is in Paoli, Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? He used to live here.
Yeah. Here. So these forces definitely exist, and I think you're right to be thinking about, mm-hmm. is there a possible friction point? And as a community, we have to stay vigilant.
For me, the unfortunately, when you posed that question, my thought wasn't, oh, if it'll happen or not. But what's going to happen and what's that going to look like? We should be vigilant. I think that this is something that's going to make some people angry and uncomfortable. It is the, I hope nothing happens, but I'm sort of just waiting to see what it is that does happen.
There have been increasing tensions on campus with the increasing number of Muslim students and many of those being women who are in full burqa and hijab. Yeah. I know that these are already tensions in town, on campus, in various ways. And so to me, I was also thinking not if something would happen, but sadly, well, when? And how do we prepare to meet that? I mean, try to hopefully diffuse it before it happens, but also what do we put into place to sort of combat that?
My current sort of work is looking at white nationalists and the communication between them. And it's very easy to sort of point and perceive actions coming from some organized body, as opposed to just mundane, everyday hostilities, right? And so that's why I'm saying infrastructure is what's more important, not sort of anticipating some massive attack from one of these types of groups. So what happens when one of these Syrian refugees come? She attempts to normalize herself by being here working at a coffee shop. She begins to date somebody who's American, and he sexually assaults her in the middle of the relationship, and she wishes to find recourse and turn to the police, right? and she gets none. Well, that's not going to be on our radar because we're waiting for the Islamophobic attack, as opposed to the fact that her gender, as well as her sort of immigrant status, prevents her from having any sort of recourse in terms of just everyday representation. And that's what we need to be ensuring that, the infrastructure is ready for.
I think the U.S. has a major problem when it comes to looking in the mirror and thinking its way is the only way in the world. It was against the law, it is international law, to spread hate against another peoples. And yet we abstain from participating in that international law. I really worry about vets being used in the police force. Temple Grandin, she's a really articulate PhD, high-performing autistic person, and she believes that everyone has something to offer. The thing is, this is everybody's problem.
My name's Joe. I just had a quick question. If we're talking about doing any of this kind of stuff sustainably, whether it's professionally for a living, academically, et cetera, or just as a human being, part of it, I think, always is around self-care or whatever language you want to use. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious then, since we're trying to keep it local and concrete, for anyone that might want to share, what is something that you do just on a personal or individual level on the daily to build up resiliency and keep yourself balanced, and or when stuff just gets totally overwhelming, whether it's election stuff, whether it's the work around anti-oppression, or whether it's just walking through the world.
For me, I came to Bloomington understanding that I wasn't going to have a huge community of people who I could trust, but I was hoping that I could have at least a couple of people who would be, and so that's who I lean on. And so it's a lot of just conversations and venting and I can't believe and oh my God, and you know, just a range of just venting and talking. And I think for me, the one thing that has kept me going is just continuing to learn. I think that in going back to being a student and getting to look into the history and learn more about like different groups, I think that that is what has recharged me time and time again. So it's like a combo of I read more, I learn more, I get really mad, I vent and let it out, and then I go back to the books.
What do you do for self-care?
Music and people, and for me, church. So I have try to keep a spiritual guide about what I'm trying to do, not just always, you know, just within my own head. So, you know, I think that those kind of things help.
Yeah, before I was a volunteer with WFHB, I was a listener, and there were a lot of kitchen dance parties from different shows. I also practice yoga, which I've done for a long time. And so for me, that's the practice that works. But I think physicality, you know, we're embodied, and we have to care for our bodies. Mm-hmm. So whatever way that works for you, I think we have to have that commitment.
At least for me, in terms of my perspective, man, I still try to keep the self-care firmly connected to the sort of political position that I'm in. So having a sense of accountability, being connected, as Berenice was saying, in terms of a community, but a community that is actively sort of working on stuff, that is a great sort of way to self-care, because then you have a population of people that you can sort of vent in a specific way. But the other thing is that I've done this for so long, I refuse to see an alternative. When you see an alternative, you're always sort of, well, I could be doing this. But if you see this is it, then it is normal, right? And so when you're sort of needing to stop, you're just taking a break for continuing to do the work, as opposed to like this other life that you kind of want to live.
I think for me, I mean, it's pretty simple. I run every day with my dog. She demands it, but it's also really good for me. I have a small group of girlfriends that I can cry with, laugh with, commiserate with, not just on the phone, but here locally, who I can go out and drink martinis with. Having that network of friends, having the, you know, running with my dog every day. And for me, church, my faith is really important to me and really is very grounding for me. So
I guess I wanted to echo some of the themes that you all brought up, but then also go back to an assumption that was made, and I just wanted to address explicitly, which is that the Bloomington Police Department hasn't been involved in lethal violence against black people. And so I wanted to both talk about the situation 6 years ago where Chris was a 16-year-old who was at the old bus stop on 4th Street. According to all the initial eyewitness reports, he was approached by police officers and calmly began walking away when he was shot in the back. Those eyewitnesses witnesses shut up pretty quickly, and the Herald Times reported later that he had attempted a suicide by police and that he had called the cops on himself, which he always denied, and that he came at them waving a knife, which, again, the original eyewitnesses had disappeared. And at that point, it was a situation that we're all really familiar with, probably, which is that it's the word of a police officer against the word of a young black man. And he was charged with attempted murder on an officer. He was expelled from school and ran out of town, basically in return for his charges being dropped. And I wanted to raise also that 2 years ago, Eddie Calloway was shot to death on the B-line, that he had already been subdued by officers and frisked and was being held on the ground, and he allegedly pulled a gun out of his pants pocket and shot himself in the head while he was face down. And again, if we believe that Freddie Gray killed himself in the back of a Baltimore police van, or if Eric Garner managed to, you know, break his own windpipe, then we can say it's like guaranteed that we should believe the police story. But generally, it really begs disbelief. And we don't know what happened, but we do know that people accepted that this happened because he was wanted for shooting his wife, and that because he wasn't able to present himself, or he wasn't able to be presented as like an innocent, upstanding citizen, that he was thus liable to death, and nobody questioned this really unbelievable thing that happened. So I do think that it's really important that we don't fall into a discourse that emphasizes innocence. And I also would just say that I'm really glad that the question of the attack against the demonstration last week was brought up. But I do think that while factually the protest was peaceful, that even if people hadn't been peaceful, they don't deserve to be mowed down.
Correct.
So I just wanted to like highlight this, because this is a thing that in Bloomington, if this is a progressive place, that mostly just means that a lot of energy and a lot of money is put into maintaining its progressive image, which also means that when lethal violence happens, that it is going to not be presented as such. And then the last thing I just wanted to say as an example of this, and I wanted, this is a way of returning to this sort of thorny problem of people raising All Lives Matter, is that a couple years ago when I was distributing flyers on the Hill about the uprising in Ferguson, one of the responses I got that was, you know, generally people were really excited that people were fighting back against the police. But one of the angrier responses I got was from a white mother. She told me the story about her son having his neck stomped by the police and his neck broken, and he survived, but it was reported by the police as him jumping out of a second story window. And so, again, I think there's like real contradictions that have to be sorted out, where we have to assert the specificity of white supremacy and of anti-black violence, but then also be able to recognize that to a lesser degree, lethal police violence is also directed against other poor people.
One of the things I think it's important to sort of keep in mind is that these incidences have been happening at North for decades, and it took the students and the faculty walking over and demanding change before something happened yesterday. To me, that was really encouraging, right? That we've got young people across the country who are actually like making their voices heard. And I think that sometimes it sort of should shame those of us who are a little bit older, because clearly things weren't going to change at North unless the students stood up and said, enough's enough. And maybe this isn't going to be the end of the conversation for them, but they were like, wow, we can make a difference. And that in and of itself is really empowering and a beautiful thing.
You just finished listening to WFHB's Backyard Conversation about Race and Privilege. The panel served to discuss topics of race, racism, privilege, and policing, with a specific emphasis on the local. The panel was hosted by WFHB's Interchange host, Doug Storm. The panelists included Bernice Sanchez, Rasul Moat, Jennifer Brooks, and William Morris. The panel was moderated by Emerita Myers.
Been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio WFHB.